Welcome to The Paranoid Strain. This is an episode in the middle of our long-term, multi-part examination of the history, philosophy, and implications of human interactions with non-human intelligence. We call it unidentified because we're fancy, but you can think of it as our big UFO series. If this is your first ever episode, you might want to skip back to unidentified number one in the RSS feed to get the whole story. Please note, some of the voices you hear, especially celebrities, are generated by AI, because we feel it makes our book excerpts and other quotes more interesting. Rest assured that Fearful, Dana, and our interviewees are always us real humans, and we'll never cut that corner, now or in the future. Returning Strainiacs, we have a few requests. First, please email us at theparanoidstrain@gmail.com with feedback. We love it. If you use Facebook, please look up and join our friendly, active group. We also set up a YouTube channel, mostly just to help people find out about the podcast. But if you could subscribe, ring the bell, and play a couple of episodes in the background as you work, that would help us show up in the algorithm for folks that might enjoy us and swell our unholy ranks of fans. Finally, anyone who wants to go that extra mile is invited to join our Patreon at patreon.com/theparanoidstrain. If you subscribe at the $5 tier, I will eventually mention you in one of these intros, embroiling you in an imaginary conspiracy theory, as I'm about to do for patron Tim Lumpkins, known far and wide as Old Grits and Gravy. Now, I reckon lots of folks have been plumb confused about how Tim got that there moniker. Most conclude it's on account of how his last name's Lumpkins, and both of them tasty foodstuffs taste their best when they have just a few lumps in them. Same thing with mashed taters, I'd say. Well, I'm here to tell you they got that all wrong. Tim's known as Old Grits and Gravy on account of his stunning heroism and quick thinking when on a long haul he passed a grits factory going up in flames. Well, Tim deliberately jackknifed his rig, spun the tanker 180 degrees, and deluged that conflagration with 10,000 gallons of Mama's original brand Red Eye Gravy, dousing the flames, saving not only the factory, but pert near the whole town to boot. Thanks, OGG. I'll see you at the dedication ceremony for your commemorative plaque.
Thanks to all of you patrons for supporting us directly, and to all of the rest of you for listening and sharing. It means the world to us. Now, let's get this show on the road. Paranoid Strain Orchestra, hit it. With that, we'll leave the biblical alien speculation and move on to discuss another pet von Daniken theory, that ETs were the intelligent designers who took the raw clay of early hominids and via genetic manipulation
and or a lot of alien proto-human banging
created the advanced modern human race, which for some reason he thinks cannot have evolved naturally, though he seems to think that every other species did so.
A version of this argument, the I ain't related to no monkey dismissal of human evolution, was de rigueur for Jesuits high school. Even those who could be persuaded of the overwhelming evidence backing the evolution of species seemed to choke on the idea that we humans, in all our self-declared specialness, might have evolved in the same way, and therefore we might be less special than we would like to believe. Jesuits classmates claimed God molded Adam out of clay. Von Daniken believes the ETs juiced up the Cro-Magnons. Both claims rest on an equal absence of evidence.
Here again, though, enthusiastic von Daniken disciples have done far more work than he could be bothered to on this topic, and so we will primarily deal with the theories espoused in Nick Redfern's book, Bloodlines of the Gods.
Clearly Redfern is trying to grab those EVD coattails for that title, huh?
Certainly appears that way.
You already noted that EVD believes that ancient aliens, and for that matter, future horny Earth astronauts, would inevitably fuck hot alien honeys and thereby sire hybrid offsprings. So what new special sauce is Retfern going to slather on top of that?
While he does, in fact, follow that basic template, he offers a lot of odd specificity that paints a thin veneer of science on top of the gobbledygook. Specifically, his book is laser-focused on the importance of the Rh-negative blood type in proving this theory.
Put simply, a small percentage of humanity, around 10 to 15%, is different from the rest. And not just slightly different, but incredibly different. Physically, mentally, spiritually, and even psychically different. This near-unique body of individuals are the Rh-negatives, a term taken from the fact that their blood is, in a word, unique. Its very existence goes against everything that Charles Darwin stood for, and that Darwinism and the theory of evolution still stands for today.
That last bit may have you thinking that Redfern is a creationist, but don't worry, like EVD, he understands that evolution accurately describes how species on Earth developed. He just thinks humans are the exceptions, and especially these super special Rh-negative people.
What the hell is up with this Rh-negative thing?
I am completely unqualified to explain this to everyone, but then again, I'm a middle-aged white man with his own podcast, which, as we all know, means I get to declare myself an expert on whatever I want. So here goes. You know how everyone has a blood type? O, A, B, or AB? And each of those comes in both positive and negative versions? And while ideally it's best for people who need blood to receive their own type, that failing that there's a sort of compatibility hierarchy, like AB plus people can only donate to other AB plus people because their blood will fuck up any other blood type that receives it, while O negative people are considered universal donors because their blood is okay for anybody. But they can only use O negative blood for themselves. And for example, O positives, like yours truly, when I give blood, it can be used by any of the positive groups. O, A, B, or AB.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Right, so what we're concerned with is the positive or negative part of those blood types, a designation originally discovered in research on rhesus monkeys, thus the reason it's called Rh. There's a pretty good explainer for why Rh is a big deal, especially for procreation, in this video we found on YouTube.
85% of humans in the world are Rh positive and have no issues receiving blood from positive or negative donors. But for the Rh negative population, receiving Rh positive blood may be fatal, as the body will try to destroy the foreign antigens.
If a rhesus positive and a rhesus negative parents were to have an offspring, there is a potential danger to the offspring because these two blood types can't interbreed, basically. Medical intervention is needed. It's why, actually, in the past, people had to have a blood test before they were allowed to get married.
That is informative, but what does this have to do with Ancient Aliens?
We're about to find out, because this clip is from the TV series Ancient Aliens, which we will get to later on, and it uses the solid science that we just heard in its introduction to then launch into some more out-there claims about those with Rh-negative blood, featuring the voiceover of none other than Mr. Redfern himself.
How on earth could this happen? It suggests somewhere in our lineage that the Rh-negatives and the Rh-positives are perceived as being profoundly different. And also, studies of Rh-negatives suggest that they have lower than normal blood pressure, lower than normal pulse. In a number of cases, they have an extra vertebra in their back.
But then the narration really goes off the rails and sets us up nicely for the allegations in Mr. Redfern's book.
Could the Rh-negative blood type offer evidence of a vastly different pre-human evolution than what we are led to believe in our history books? Might it offer indisputable proof of extraterrestrial intervention in the remote past? But if so, is the experimentation with intelligent hominin over? Or is it still taking place?
Earlier we mentioned that around 15% of Americans have one of the negative blood types, but it turns out that the percentages of Rh negatives vary widely based on ethnicity. Redfern notes, and reliable sources confirm, that people of European extraction are much more likely to have negative blood types, that's around 16% for the continent as a whole, while African percentages are much lower, with Nigerians around 6% and other sub-Saharan Africans at around 3%. Asia is a virtual Rh negative wasteland with Koreans, Japanese, and Chinese people all coming in at less than 1% Rh negative. Now, as a rule, Rh negative blood doesn't make that much difference to the way people live their lives. If anything, given that it could make having a baby or getting blood in an emergency more complicated, it seems like a slight disadvantage on the margins. But as you might expect, because it occurs more often in white people, racist assholes have tried to turn it into some sort of Aryan superiority indicator. We mention this only because irony is amusing. How did this and other variations in blood type happen? I mean, considering it from a purely evolutionary standpoint, it seems weird that humans would have developed a factor that could make their blood incompatible with the majority of their species, thus leading to many complications and fatalities among newborns whose parents had mismatched blood.
At least, that is, until medical science created drugs that prevent this problem.
A 2019 New York Times article by Rose George quotes Connie Westhoff of the New York Blood Center explaining that the variance, quote, has been driven by evolutionary selection by bacteria, malaria, and parasites. The article goes on to use the example of the sickle cell gene, which causes a horrible syndrome in a small percentage of those who carry it, but for the rest provides a good genetic defense against malaria, the disease that has likely killed more humans than anything else in our history. And there are trade-offs. O-type blood offers some protection against malaria, but that blood type is more susceptible to cholera.
So Rh negative blood protects against the specific disease?
Scientists haven't figured out a complete picture of what the negative type might protect against. Some studies have shown a link with resistance to toxoplasmosis, but there's nothing definitive and research is ongoing. Not that we need research, because Nick Redfern has already figured it out. The Rh negatives are truly a different breed than their positive counterparts because their DNA has more alienness than the rest of us positives.
Oh, obviously. I guess we can tell the researchers to call off the experiments then.
To be fair, Mr. Redfern admits that we should eliminate other candidate explanations before jumping to the totally reasonable conclusion that Rh negative people are part alien.
Before we get to the controversial matter of ancient extraterrestrials manipulating the human bloodline in the distant past, it's important that we first rule out down-to-earth explanations for the Rh negative factor. After all, asserting that some of us are the result of alien gene tinkering is not something that should be done lightly.
Alas, Redfern finds all non-ET explanations quite wanting.
I'm shocked.
Comparing Rh to merely cosmetic genetic distinctions, he writes,
it's very important to note there's no evidence to suggest that the color of hair, skin, or eyes can have a bearing upon the personality, mindset, or belief systems of an individual. Blood of one particular type, however, can have such a bearing, and a highly significant one too, in certain people.
If your bullshit detector is going off, congratulations. Also, it's only going to get louder.
Those with Rh negative blood are very often of a specific mindset, displaying a deep and keen interest in science, UFOs, and unexplained phenomena. They have higher than average psychic abilities, such as precognition and extrasensory perception.
You hear that, Dana? They have stronger, made-up, non-existent psychic abilities than us filthy Rh positives, and the differences don't stop there.
Their IQ is typically higher than that of most people. Physically, they're different too. A low body temperature, slow pulse, extra vertebrae, and low blood pressure are all common in the Rh negatives. They're far more resilient to illness, viruses, and disease than the rest of the human population. And as we will see later, there is good evidence in hand that demonstrates clandestine groups within both the US government and military have secretly monitored the rise of the Rh negatives and carefully studied their associations to the UFO phenomenon. When we put all of this together, we are faced with what appears to be nothing less than a careful, controlled manipulation of certain portions of the human race, both physically and mentally.
It is with a heavy heart that I tell you the conclusions Mr. Redfern has drawn in the preceding pages are not reflected in high-quality, evidence-based scientific studies.
Knock me over with a feather.
I know. Don't worry. We'll get through this together. My confidence stems indirectly from the generosity of our Patreon patrons, thanks to whom I was able to buy the show a subscription to the excellent publication The Skeptical Inquirer, where I found a delightfully thorough article by Dr. Ellen K. Tarr, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Midwestern University, titled, Everything You Know About Being Rh Negative Is Wrong.
and which might as well have been subtitled, "And I am talking specifically to you, Nick Redfern."
In the piece, Dr. Tarr reiterates the many physical characteristics:
blue, green, or hazel eyes, red or reddish hair, low body temperature, low pulse, low or high blood pressure, extra rib or vertebrae, vestigial tail, larger than average forehead, unexplained body scars, unclonable blood, heightened senses, sensitivity to heat, sunlight, and the ability to disrupt electrical appliances.
And the various mental or personality traits:
high IQ, a truth-seeking nature, a compassionate, empathetic nature, tendency toward empathetic illnesses, manifesting another person's symptoms, tendency toward healing professions, a sense of having a mission in life, a sense of otherworldly feeling, tendency to have paranormal experiences, tendency to be easily shocked, and an interest in space or science.
All of the preceding are, according to conspiracy theorists, supposedly evidenced more often in Rh-negative individuals than the general Rh-positive public. Dr. Tarr dryly notes that she found very little support for these claims in the relevant academic literature.
I bet.
Those physical traits that do occur more frequently in Rh-negative individuals, like red hair and blue or hazel eyes, are explained simply because Europeans are disproportionately likely to have these traits, and coincidentally are also vastly more likely than other races to be Rh-negative.
In other words, it's correlation, not causation.
And as far as personality traits, legitimate research sources indicate a few possible connections to negative blood, but even those are quite tenuous. Maybe Rh-negatives on the whole are slightly less novelty-seeking, maybe a little more persistent, and perhaps there's a small increase in the tendency toward opioid addiction compared to Rh-positives. But she caveats even these, because many of the traits claimed by Redfern and other believers in magical alien Rh-negatives are complex and difficult to score and interpret, even for experts. So we have ample reason to doubt the vague self-reported studies believers tend to rely on. Definitive conclusions are tough to pin down because standards vary.
And of course, don't forget the imaginary shit Redfern et al. Vouch for, including ESP, psychic powers, etc.
Redfern's theory does still have one Rh-negative big gun. That is, the fact that a particular European ethnic group is maybe 35% Rh-negative, the highest proportion of any ethnicity in the world. So, like, aliens.
And what nation houses this magical group of ESP-gifted half-alien demigods?
I assume you're hoping it's the Danes, but it's not. The group in question is the Basques. The Basque region, as Wikipedia will tell you, is centered in the Pyrenees Mountains that straddle the western portion of the border between Spain and France, and include the cities of Bilbao, Pamplona, and Bayonne. The natives maintain a fiercely independent culture, including their own modes of dress, music, and even language. Here again, I barely know what I'm talking about, but I know people. In this case, I know longtime economist reporter, linguist, and current Spanish resident Lane Green, paranoid strain pseudonym LG Sweet, who has appeared on this show a number of times to explain language and culture stuff. I asked him once again to swoop in here and briefly explain the actual non-UFO, non-Rh-negative ways that Basque culture is unique, and what implications that has had for both Basque people and their larger neighbors.
I'm Lane Green, a.k.a. LG Sweet. I am the Spain correspondent for The Economist magazine, as well as its language writer. And I am here to tell you a little bit about Spain, the Basques, where they fit in, and their rather unusual language. We don't know exactly where the Basques come from, because they were already there when sort of writing historians, a.k.a. the Romans, showed up in Spain, which is a couple of centuries before the birth of Christ. And the Romans called them the Vascones, so that's where we get their name. And they were kind of up north in Spain. So One of the key things to know about the Basques is that they're in the slightly inhospitable mountain territory, which is kind of a belt that cuts off the northern coast of Spain from everything else south and in the middle. They were a little bit hard to subdue, and they have maintained a remarkable level of independence ever since then, and for who knows how long before. The Basques stick out from the rest of not only Spain, but France, where they also are, and all their neighbors, really, in a couple of different ways, one of which is that their blood type is unusual in that far west of Europe. And they have a heavy prevalence of Rh negative in their blood types, and that's something that makes geneticists curious. What we really know about what makes the Basques so distinct is that they speak a language unrelated to any of the neighboring languages in Europe. Nearly all the languages in Europe are part of a single family, the Indo-European family, which is a massive family of languages. They say it goes from Donegal to Bengal, which is to say it goes from Ireland all the way through to the east of India and Bangladesh, including the North Indian languages, Persian, and basically almost all the European languages. There's a family of languages that isn't part of that group, which is the Finno-Ugric group. That includes Finnish, Estonian, and Hungarian, and they're not Indo-European, but Basque is truly unusual in that it's not part of any known family. In other words, it's an isolate in linguistics terms. It has no known relatives. There have been efforts to connect it to other languages, but these are all totally speculative and none remotely proven. As far as linguists are concerned, for now, Basque is an isolated language, and that's you know pretty rare in the world stage because most languages can be grouped nicely into families, and that's part of the Basque claim to have been there longer than just about anybody. The other thing about the Basques is they have somewhat different kind of culinary traditions, clothes. They're a little bigger, or they're perceived as big and burly. In Spain, they have some unusual sports, jaili, and a game called frontón, where they basically pelota, where they hit a ball against a wall with their hand. They do this thing where they chop wood really fast in contests, and you can also Google YouTube videos of that. So they have really unusual, you know, customs for the neighborhood. The beret is a Basque hat. It's not really French or Spanish. But I think more than anything, it really is the language, which you're really just at first glance, if you see it on the page, you see all manner of K's and X's and things like that that are quite unusual in European languages. Spain is kind of what they call a composite country in the sense that it was kind of glommed together from kingdoms that married and had dynastic unions. And the famous one, of course, is Ferdinand and Isabella marrying and unifying Castile and Aragon. But the kingdom that is relevant to the Basques is the Kingdom of Navarre, which is kind of north, that's on the French border, includes most of the modern Basque country, most of what is now the Spanish region of Navarre as well, and part of France. And it was a pretty major kingdom in its day, but its peak was kind of well before Ferdinand and Isabella. And by the time you get the union of Castile and Aragon, they're the kind of big dog in the Iberian Peninsula. And they end up gobbling up and absorbing Navarre into Castile as well. But the Basque identity never went away. They really feel like they are distinct. They speak a different language, have all these different cultural traits that I mentioned. And that identity never disappeared. And in various times in Spanish history, they've fought against unity with the rest of Spain. When there was a dynastic dispute in the 19th century that sparked three civil wars called the Carlist Wars. And in all those cases, both the Basques and the Catalans really backed the losing side. And that's because they resented the kind of the centralizing tendencies of Spain at that time. They get weaker and weaker. And then in the Francisco Franco dictatorship, which is 1939 to 75, you get a real repression of the peripheral nationalities in Spain, the Basques, the Catalans, the Galicians, in favor of a centralizing dictatorship focused on Castile in the center of Spain. And that led to the terrorist organization ETA rising up first against Franco. Franco dies in 1975. You get a democracy in 1978, but the Basques feel like they haven't been given enough. And so ETA continues killing people through the 1970s and 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s before a definitive ceasefire in 2011. They still claim the independence of the Basque country. They want not only the Basque provinces of Spain, but part of Navarre and the Basque provinces of France to be a Basque homeland, but this looks pretty far away from reality at this point. Hundreds of people were killed by ETA terrorism. For a time, they really focused on killing soldiers and police, but they definitely infuriated Spaniards by also overreaching and killing civilians, bombing a big supermarket in Barcelona and things like that. There was a real revulsion in the rest of Spain. And finally, they killed a young politician from the Conservative People's Party in the Basque country. Miguel Ángel Blanco was his name. And the fury at his killing which was totally unwarranted because his family didn't come up with a ransom or something quickly enough, kind of was the beginning of the end of ETA. Public opinion across Spain, even in the Basque Country, turned so strongly. You got this definitive renunciation of violence. ETA still has a political, sort of a descendant of its political wing, represented in the Spanish Parliament. You could consider it the kind of a Sinn Féin of Spain, in that it is the political wing of a former terrorist group.
Still, at the end, I wasn't convinced. Somewhere deep down, I knew he was keeping a secret from me, that the Basque really were exactly as Mr. Redfern described.
Well, you know, we don't have written records of the Basques showing up in the Iberian Peninsula in southern France, so alien DNA, why not? I mean, really, is there proof that there isn't alien DNA there? I mean, I'd like to see it. I haven't seen it. I've been asking people, prove to me that the Basques are not aliens, and no one has managed to produce the sort of smoking gun, as it were, that the Basques are Homo sapiens evolved by, you know, natural selection very gradually from a larger hominid family with no aliens involved. And once somebody kind of closes that case for me, well, I'm just asking questions, really.
Now, what Nick Redfern wants you to understand is that all of the preceding consensus, evidence-backed information about the Basques is just a smokescreen covering up the real important facts. And further, when he says the Basques are different than other groups, he literally means their anatomies are different, as he explains here.
The chins and jaws of the Basques are far more powerful and sturdy-looking than average. Their earlobes are overly long. Their noses unnoticeably prominent. And their eyebrows are bushy, very often to an extreme degree.
To this point, it just sounds like the Basques are the old guys who hang out naked in my gym's locker room. He continues,
in the Basque history of the world, Mark Kalansky quotes the words of an 1880s-era observer of the Basque people, who said, someone gave me a Basque body, and I dissected it, and I assert that the head was not built like that of other men.
Paranoid strain, pro tip. When you're reading a book that makes outrageous claims, and it backs those claims with a 143-year-old extremely vague reference to another book, quoting an unnamed observer whose qualifications aren't mentioned, saying something incredibly nonspecific about a whole group of people based on one person's head, you might not be reading rigorous scholarship.
As for the body of the Basques, the differences are most obvious in the men. They are generally possessed of muscular chests, wide shoulders, and thick and solid arms. Of course, anyone can bulk up with a dedicated exercise regime and a calorie-loaded diet. For the Basques, however, this is their natural appearance. It was also the appearance of the Cro-Magnons, who lived in exactly the same area. Does that mean that Cro-Magnon man was himself Rh negative? Yes, almost certainly.
Now, back here in the real world, we know that Cro-Magnon is the name anthropologists gave to the genetically modern humans who first populated the European continent, and whose habitation was definitely not limited to modern Basque country. But this special supposed connection of the Basques to their Cro-Magnon forebears is very important to Redfern, as it's the pivot of his particular version of the ancient alien DNA manipulation story. I'll have Dana synopsize briefly, saving you several hundred pages of tedious, tendentious argument.
In Redfern's telling, the aliens spliced their DNA, which again, for some reason, worked with the off-the-shelf human version, in spite of their having evolved on two completely different fucking planets. This created a new race, the Cro-Magnon people, some tens of thousands of years ago. These strong, capable new hybrids still had rivals, though, in the form of the existing proto-human Neanderthal species, who were extant throughout Europe at the time. How did the advanced visitors deal with this problem? Perhaps the chapter title, Did ETs Wipe Out the Neanderthals, provides a clue to our author's thinking. Dismissing prominent mainstream theories that some combination of factors, including disease, food shortages due to climate change, and conflict with those selfsame early modern human Cro-Magnons, he asserts the most likely scenario, that Neanderthals were taken down by a custom-made alien virus designed to leave the preferred human hybrid race standing after all of the Neanderthals had bitten the dust.
It bears repeating that Redfern dismisses the totally reasonable suggestion that maybe normal earthbound viruses and bacteria played a part in wiping out the Neanderthals, but then turns around and comes out in favor of a completely hypothetical and unwarranted targeted alien bioweapon doing the same thing. If this kind of motivated reasoning could be packaged and sold, I swear I would eat it with a spoon. Once he's finished with his version of the Cro-Magnon to Basque story, Redfern settles in to document further examples of the claimed differences between Rh negatives and the rest of us, the vast majority of which we dismissed earlier. We don't want to keep beating a dead horse, especially when that dead horse is insisting that blood type is somehow giving people super-enhanced ESP, but there are a few fun items to mention here. For example, one of the things he points to is the very large purported incidence of synchronicities in the lives of Rh negatives. In other words, their days abound with meaningful coincidences. What made me literally giggle out loud was that the first example he gives of a synchronicity, that situation where you think of someone you haven't thought of in months or years, and then that person calls you within hours, he insists that phenomena like that are evidence that our minds can alter or create the reality that we experience. However, those who, like me, have read Thomas Gilovich's classic How We Know What Isn't So,
which Jesuit insists would be a first ballot inductee in a hypothetical skeptical hall of fame. So, like, read it.
The subtitle is The Fallibility of Human Reason in Everyday Life, and the author uses this exact out-of-the-blue phone call example to illustrate one of these failures, and the many sensible, non-psychic explanations for events of this kind. These include...
One?
We tend to forget the many, many times we think of someone and that person doesn't call.
Two?
Over a human lifetime, many odd things are almost bound to happen. Over 8 billion simultaneous overlapping human lifetimes, as many have noted, a 1 in a million chance happens 8,000 times a day.
3.
These claims ignore other factors. For example, you might have thought of a person because of some event, anniversary, or other factor, the same thing that triggered the person to give you the mysterious phone call in the first place.
Aw, you should have seen his face when he realized that Redfern was choosing a classic example of faulty logic to prove his assertion. It was precious.
Other intriguing and unlikely suggestions include the assertion that Rh negatives disproportionately experience inherited memories. In other words, that they relive experiences not from their own, but rather their parents' or other ancestors' lifetimes.
He even provides a reference to a study proving that inherited memories are a real thing.
This study, admittedly, appears relatively legit and was published in the distinguished magazine Nature in 2013. It gives some indication that mice exposed to a maze their parents had navigated were able to get through it more quickly than mice whose parents hadn't been exposed to the maze. It seems to be a real legit thing, though we don't know what the cause is. But in a more recent analysis of the evidence for human inheritance of trauma and other factors from previous generations, a New York Times story quotes a neurology and genetics professor as saying that these types of extraordinary claims are being, and I quote, advanced on less than ordinary evidence. And of course, there's no indication that, even if inherited memory proved to be a thing, we would have any reason to think that Rh negatives are more prone to it than Rh positives. And even if they were, that would still do nothing to forward his thesis that the reason is because aliens done it. Finally, Redfern asserts that one telltale clue the alien gene manipulators left us is the fact that Rh negatives are more likely to be interested in UFOs and associated phenomena than positives. And you'll never guess the name of his prime Rh negative alien fanatic exemplar.
It's von Daniken, isn't it?
Oh, apparently you will guess then. Just to hammer a few final nails in this coffin, one of the things that Rh-negative alien conspiracists insist is evidence for their cause is that otherwise there's no explaining where the Rh-negatives come from. I mean, if we're all the same species, each human's blood type should reproductively be compatible with every other human's blood type. After all, there's no other animal where this kind of parental blood type mismatch can lead to potentially fatal consequences for their offspring. Except, of course, that's not true. The animal phenomenon known as neonatal isoerythrolysis, probably pronouncing that wrong, affects horses, dogs, cats, and any other species where the possibility of a negative-positive blood type distinction exists.
So, are we to imagine that the aliens also created hybrid alien cat species? And that these cats have powers far beyond other felines?
In other words, as science so often proves to our chagrin, humans are nothing special. While researchers haven't pinned down exactly why and how the Rh-negative trait evolved, and what, if any, benefits it may convey, this sort of thing is actually what we would expect from the gradual evolution of an immune system that is, above all, concerned with protecting the host from all potential threats entering the body. That is, that the system will sometimes, tragically, turn against the distinct life growing inside of a mother seeing a potential threat. In fact, the Rh negative isn't even the only type of blood mismatch problem mothers and babies can have. It's possible, for example, that an O-type mother could carry a B-type baby, and if any complications brought those blood types in contact, a very similar immune rejection issue would impact that pregnancy as well.